Sometimes I...
Yeah, well, a bullet don't care about sometimes. So when the time comes, keep your head down.
Matt and Sam saw a wagon roll out of the settlement carrying Jesse Colton and the rest of the Colton clan. Her father, Shad, was at the reins, handling the team of fine black horses. Half a dozen hard-faced cowboys rode behind the wagon, punchers from the Colton spread, no doubt. A short time later, the Paxton family departed in much the same manner, traveling in a big, sturdy wagon, accompanied by several gun-hung waddies. Matt and Sam noted the families made a point of leaving Sweet Apple at different times.
Do you think we should have warned them about Mallory?
From the way the girls were talking, their ranches are a good long way out of town. They shouldn't be in any danger.
Mallory and his men might raid the ranches.
Mallory's not a rustler. Wide looping cattle is too much work for a varmint like him. He's just interested in loot he can grab without going to a lot of trouble, like in a bank. And killing. He's interested in killing.
We ought to take a ride out to those spreads and warn them.
Maybe in a day or two, after we've got things more squared away here.
Sam went along with that idea. The biggest threat was still definitely directed at Sweet Apple. By that evening, a force of 22 men was ready to defend the town in case of attack. Of course, other men would fight too if it came to that, but these 22 knew in advance of the possible danger and would be ready at all times to oppose it. The only outward sign was the presence of three men on guard duty, one on the roof of the Black Bull, another in the bell tower of the Mission on the edge of town, and the third perched on the roof of the hotel. If any of them detected any signs of an attack, they would fire three shots in the air to alert the rest of the defenders. The nearest telegraph office was at Fort Davis, several days' ride away, but a rider was sent to wire the Texas Rangers for help. Any assistance from the Rangers was probably at least a week off, though. Matt and Sam doubted the outlaws would delay their attack that long. The citizens of Sweet Apple were pretty much on their own. That evening, after supper with Matt and Sam, Seymour set out to make his rounds by himself, as he usually did. For the time being, he didn't want to vary his routine. Matt and Sam alerted him to the possibility Mallory might have spies in Sweet Apple. Strangers came and went all the time in the settlement. The defenders didn't want to tip their hand and allow Mallory to discover he would meet heavy resistance when he raided the town. It would be different if such a possibility would deter the outlaws from attacking. In Mallory's case, though, such a discovery would probably make them launch their strike sooner, before the citizens could get any more organized. Listening to the Blood Brothers talk, Seymour realized just how much he had to learn about strategy if he was ever going to be a good fighting man. Not that he ever had the ambition, until now. As Seymour checked the door at the saddle shop, he felt his heart give a little jump as he recognized a figure ahead of him on the boardwalk. Maggie O'Ryan was coming toward him. She paused suddenly, as if she just noticed him too and wasn't sure whether to keep coming or not. They were still rather shy around each other, despite the fact they enjoyed supper together twice. Seymour wasn't officially courting her, at least not yet, but... Maggie lifted her chin and started walking toward him again. Seymour swallowed and resumed his own journey along the boardwalk. When they got closer to each other, he nodded.
Good evening, Maggie.
Hello, Seymour. How are you?
Fine.
He hated the small talk of a new relationship like this. What he really wanted was to take her in his arms and kiss her. But he couldn't do that, of course. It would be highly improper. He felt worry course through him when he thought Maggie would be in danger, too, if the Mallory gang attacked the settlement. Maybe he ought to warn her. He caught himself before he said anything about it. The outlaws might have bypassed Sweet Apple and already be in Mexico by now. Until he could determine one way or the other, he didn't want to cause Maggie unnecessary worry.
How has attendance been at school the past few days?
Surprisingly good. Even Oliver Delacroix attends every day. It's like the parents in Sweet Apple finally realized how important it is for their children to get an education. My hope is the town is beginning to settle down at last. After all, we have a real marshal now.
His natural self-deprecation prepared him to say he didn't know about that, but he stopped himself.
And a real school as well. Civilization's getting quite a foothold here.
He was about to ask her to have dinner with him again sometime when a couple of figures loomed behind Maggie on the boardwalk. One of them, a short, broad man, bumped heavily against her shoulder as she started past. Matt and Sam told Seymour to make his rounds by himself, as he usually did. That didn't mean they were leaving the safety of the town to the inexperienced young lawman. They started making a circuit of Sweet Apple for themselves, keeping to the shadows, looking for any indication Deuce Mallory might be trying something more sneaky this time, like infiltrating some of his men into the settlement before attacking with the rest of his gang.
Something's happened. Mallory wouldn't change his tactics like this without a good reason.
Yeah, I reckon I agree with you. Shocked the hell out of me he hadn't already hit this place when we got here.
You think he's not even coming?
You know how it feels when somebody's got a gun pointed at you?
You know damn well I do.
Well, that's the way I feel. Like I've got a big old target painted on my chest and somebody's drawing a bead on it. That tells me Mallory's still out there, and he plans to raid this place.
My instincts tell me the same thing. It's just a matter of time.
They moved on, circling the livery stable. Everything about the settlement was peaceful and quiet this evening, except for the usual night noises, which in Sweet Apple included tinny piano music and brassy laughter from the saloons. The Blood Brothers paused in the thick shadows at the mouth of an alley.
Look over there, across the street.
Matt looked and saw Seymour Standish talking to a young woman who was short and a little stocky, but still very pretty, with long dark hair. Light from the window of a nearby building shone on the two of them.
That must be Miss Orion.
Bet she kisses her.
Seymour? I don't think so. Even though he may not actually be the most cowardly man in the West, I think he's still plenty scared of Miss Orion.
What is there to be scared of? She's just a pretty girl. That's what a fella does when there's a girl he likes. He kisses her.
Not everyone has your confidence, Matt.
Yeah, well, they oughta. You can't go through your whole life worrying about every little thing.
He stopped short as two figures came out of the shadows on the boardwalk across the street. As the men moved into the light, he recognized them as the sinister-looking varmints he spotted earlier. He had no idea who they were, but knew gun traps enough to recognize what was going on. One of them ran into Maggie Orion and nearly knocked her down.
Did you see that? We'd better go over there and see if we can give him a hand.
By God, sir, you're under arrest!
Seymour, look out!
Seymour grabbed for his gun. But the two strangers were faster. Matt's twin Colts flickered from their holsters. Even though the range and the light were a little tricky, and Seymour and Maggie were awfully close to the two would-be killers, both of the strangers got shots off, but the bullets screamed off harmlessly into the night as Matt's slugs slammed into them. Seymour got his rifle out late and fired too, adding to the sudden, deafening racket of gunfire in the street. The two strangers staggered back. Neither moved again. Matt slid his guns smoothly back into leather.
Come on!
They broke into a run as they crossed the street. Seymour still held his gun in his right hand, but his left arm was around Maggie Orion as she pressed her face against his chest and shuddered in fear.
It's all right. Those men won't hurt you. You're not hurt, are you, Maggie?
She stopped trembling long enough to shake her head.
I'm fine, Seymour. None of those shots hit me.
Me neither.
His eyes were wide with amazement as he looked over at Matt and Sam.
What happened here, Seymour? Those men.
Seymour waved his gun vaguely toward the bullet-riddled corpses.
One of them bumped into Miss Orion here. They were very rude, and I was going to arrest them for disturbing the peace. But then they drew their guns, and my God, I never heard so many shots in my life.
Yeah, you were blazing away at him when we came up, Seymour. That was good shooting.
Seymour looked at his gun in his hand, then at the dead men, then back at the gun.
I did that?
Those varmints are ventilated good and proper, and you and the lady are all right, so I reckon you must have.
But who are they? Why would they try to kill me?
I reckon they must have been rude to Miss Orion to prod you into drawing on them.
It was a trap designed to get rid of you, Seymour.
Why would anyone go to that much trouble?
Because you're the fighting marshal of Sweet Apple, that's why. Things have changed since you got here, Seymour. Might as well get used to it.
Yes, I suppose so.
Then he jammed his empty gun back in its holster, put both arms around Maggie, and brought his mouth down on hers in a kiss. She was obviously startled at first, but then she relaxed in his embrace and started returning the kiss. Matt nudged Sam again.
Told you.
The Blood Brothers dragged the corpses down the street to the undertaking parlor.
I can't believe you went through that whole charade just to get Seymour feeling bold enough to kiss Miss Orion.
That wasn't the only reason. If he's going to be able to deal with Mallory and all the other trouble he'll be facing as Marshal of Sweet Apple, he's got to believe in himself.
Yes, but now he's liable to be overconfident and get in over his head. He may try to tackle trouble he can't handle. And after all, he believes he just gunned down two men who were trying to kill him.
We'll eat that apple when it falls off the tree. Right now, he believes he can stand up to whatever comes at him. That's half of actually being able to do it, right there.
Maybe so, maybe so.
They left the bodies of the would-be killers with the Undertaker. From there, they went to the Black Bull, talked to Pierre Delacroix for a while, then headed for the hotel and turned in. As a consequence of the way their drifting usually landed them in trouble, the Blood Brothers developed the habit of sleeping lightly. Tonight was no different. Trouble would have roused them instantly from slumber. But Matt and Sam both slept through the night, waking the next morning refreshed and with the knowledge Deuce Mallory and his gang still hadn't shown up. After having breakfast in the hotel dining room and washing the food down with several cups of strong black coffee, Matt and Sam walked over to the marshal's office. They found Seymour behind his desk, looking at some papers spread out in front of him.
One of the desk drawers was full of old wanted posters. The Texas Rangers and the U.S. Marshal's office must have been sending them out on a regular basis for months, even though Sweet Apple didn't have a lawman most of that time. Someone stuck them in the desk for lack of anything better to do with them.
Find anything interesting?
Actually, I did.
Seymour turned one of the papers around and pushed it across the desk toward the Blood Brothers.
There are several wanted posters for Deuce Mallory in here, along with some of the men suspected of riding with him. This one goes back a couple of years. It was issued because of a bank robbery Mallory pulled off in Wyoming.
An artist's likeness of Mallory covered the reward dodger, no doubt based on the testimony of witnesses who saw the outlaw. Matt and Sam looked at the portrait of a man with a lean but not unhandsome face. The description printed underneath it said Mallory was about 6'2" tall and had dark red hair.
We never actually got a look at the varmint up in Buckskin. Let's see those other posters.
They studied the pictures for several minutes. Drawn by different artists in different locations, following an assortment of bloody-handed crimes, all the portraits of Mallory bore enough of a resemblance to each other for Matt and Sam to accept them as accurate representations of the outlaw.
We'll know him if we see him.
What about the notices on the other members of his gang? Let's have a look at them, too.
As best they could, they memorized the features of Mallory's subordinates. The names of some of the men were incomplete or unknown, but Matt and Sam filed away the names of Jacob Pine, Gus Brody, and Steve Larrabee. They seemed to be three of Mallory's top lieutenants.
How's Miss Orion this morning?
I wouldn't know. I haven't seen her since I walked her home last night following that unfortunate incident.
By unfortunate incident, you mean those two Eastern dudes who tried to kill you. Or that big kish you laid on the schoolmarm.
Matt and Sam both grinned as Seymour's ears turned a bright shade of pink. He ignored the question.
I spoke to Harry Talent, the local undertaker, this morning. He went through the belongings of the two dead men.
Find enough cash to take care of burying them?
Yes. And he found a letter as well that identified the, large hairy one as a man named Wilford Grant. There was nothing to say who the other man was. But that's not the interesting thing. The letter to Grant was sent to an address in Trenton, New Jersey.
You're from Trenton, aren't you, Seymour?
That's right. I was born and raised there.
But you didn't know that, gent?
I never saw him before.
There's got to be a connection. It's too big a coincidence to think those fellows came all the way out here from your hometown, then just happened to run into you and tried to bait you into a gunfight so they could kill you.
Somebody sent them after you.
But that's impossible. I don't have any enemies back in Trenton.
Not everybody.
I refuse to believe that. I've been over it and over it in my mind, and no one in Trenton has any reason to want me dead.
What about that uncle of yours, the one who sent you out here?
Uncle Cornelius? I've known him my entire life. He's my uncle, for God's sake. My father's brother.
Hamlet's uncle had a few dirty tricks up his sleeve.
There you go again, bringing up Shakespeare. You're not the only one who reads, you know.
I've seen those yellowbacks you carry around in your saddlebags. I'd hardly call Ned Buntline dime novels classics.
Well, that just shows what you know. Seymour, somebody's got it in for you. It's just plain fact, whether you want to admit it or not. And that's on top of the threat from Mallory and his bunch. You better keep your eyes wide open all the time.
I'm afraid you're right.
I know I am. We'll watch your back as much as we can, but we won't always be around here.
You're not leaving.
Not until this business with Mallory is done. But the time will come when we need to move along.
We're fiddle-footed. Can't ever stay in one place for too long. Too many things left to see somewhere down the trail.
I couldn't live like that. I already find myself putting down roots here. And I never expected that.
I reckon there are worse places to settle down. Sweet Apple ought to get plumb peaceful before too much longer.
How do you figure that?
Place has got a gunfight in town taming Marshall now.
Time dragged, as it always did when men were keyed up to face danger that failed to arrive. Matt and Sam spent the day checking with the defenders scattered around town, seeing that they were in good positions to fight off an attack and such like. As far as the Blood Brothers could tell, all the men recruited to defend the settlement were doing as asked and keeping their mouths shut. There was no air of panic in Sweet Apple, only grim readiness among those few who knew about the threat the town might be facing. The heat became sweltering during the afternoon. The sky turned brassy. Men and animals sought whatever shade they could find, and anyone who ventured out into the brutal sun started sweating within seconds. But the parched West Texas air dried that sweat up almost as fast as it formed. Sweet Apple dozed in the heat. The whole town seemed to heave a sigh of relief as the sun finally set. Evening shadows formed. The air was still hot, but at least the fierce glare of the sun was gone until morning. Matt and Sam sat in tipped-back chairs on the hotel porch with their hats pulled low over their faces and watched under the brims as riders moved slowly along the street. Nobody was going to get in a hurry in weather like this. Suddenly, Matt started to sit up. He forced himself to sit still and not show any reaction to the man he just noticed riding by. He watched from the corner of his eye as the stranger reined to a halt in front of the Black Bull, tied his horse to the hitch rack, and went into the saloon. Sam noticed the tensing of his Blood Brother's muscles, even though it wouldn't have been apparent to anyone else.
Something wrong?
Matt sat up and let the legs of his chair come down on the porch. He thumbed his hat up to its normal position.
Did you see that fellow who just rode past? He went down to the Black Bull. That's his Gruya tied up in front of the saloon now.
I saw him. Can't say as I paid much attention to him.
Well, keep an eye on his horse. I'm going to take a walk over to Seymour's office. There's something I want to be sure about.
What if the hombre you're talking about comes out of the saloon?
Follow him. I shouldn't be long, though. I'm either right or wrong.
Are you trying to be enigmatic?
No mystery. Just don't want to look like too big a fool if I'm wrong. And don't go saying it's already too late for that.
Matt sauntered down the street toward the marshal's office, hiding the tension he felt. Earlier in the evening, he and Sam saw Seymour and Maggie Orion walk over to the cafe to have supper together. Then later, the two of them returned arm in arm to Seymour's office. Knowing Seymour, Matt didn't figure he would be interrupting anything too improper, but when he reached the marshal's office, he knocked on the door anyway before entering. Seymour and Maggie were on opposite sides of the room by the time Matt got inside. Seymour stood at the desk, while Maggie was over by the gun rack, pretending to admire the Winchesters and shotguns arranged there. Both of them were a little flushed and breathless, so Matt figured there'd been some sparking going on a moment earlier.
Oh, hello, Matt. I was about to, escort Miss Orion home, then get started on my evening rounds. Perhaps you'd like to accompany me.
No thanks, Seymour. I need to look through those wanted posters again.
The ones we were looking at this morning? Of course, I have them right here. Is something wrong?
Matt glanced at Maggie.
No, nothing's wrong. I just, like to look at wanted posters.
Oh, please. That lie wouldn't fool one of my students. I know something's going on. Seymour, you've been as nervous as a cat this evening.
But that's the way I normally am.
When you first came to Sweet Apple, yes. But not now, Seymour. You've changed, probably more than you realize yourself. There's going to be some sort of trouble, isn't there?
Seymour looked to Matt for help. Matt shrugged.
You're her beau, Seymour. It's up to you how much you want to tell her.
I'm what?
My beau. And I'm not the least bit embarrassed to say that.
The blush on her face indicated that might not be completely true, but the stubborn look in her eyes and the defiant tilt of her chin told Matt Miss Maggie Orion just took a step from which she would not be turning back.
I'm actually a little offended you don't trust me enough to tell me what's going on, Seymour.
That's not it. That's not it at all. I just thought it best not to worry you if there was no need.
If you're worried, then I need to be worried too.
Seymour couldn't argue with logic like that. Leastways, he wouldn't if he had any sense, Matt thought. But Seymour's love life was the least of his concerns right now.
I still need to take a look at those reward dodgers.
Oh, yes.
Matt pawed through them until he found the one he was looking for. He separated out the wanted poster and slapped it down on the desk by itself.
That's him. It's a good likeness.
Jacob Pine. You saw him, Matt?
Riding down the street, bold as brass, no more than 5 minutes ago.
Who's Jacob Pine?
He's an outlaw. He works for a man named Deuce Mallory. That means...
Mallory must have sent him into town to have a look around and make sure nobody suspects anything. They could be planning the raid for later on tonight.
Raid?
Seymour went to her and drew her into his arms, clearly no longer caring Matt was there.
Don't worry. You'll be safe. I'll see to that.
Maggie pushed back a step.
I'm not worried about myself. I have students here in Sweet Apple. If they're in danger, Seymour, you'd better tell me.
Matt?
Go ahead and tell her. But you've got to keep this to yourself, Miss Orion, at least until we find out for sure what's going on.
How are we going to do that?
Sam and I are going to have a little palaver with Jacob Pine.
Matt returned to the hotel porch.
He's still in the saloon. Now, are you going to tell me what this is all about?
When the fellow rode past a while ago, I thought he looked familiar. I checked those wanted posters Seymour has of Mallory and his gang. And sure enough, that hombre was one of them. Name of Jacob Pine, one of Mallory's right-hand men.
That means...
Mallory sent Pine in to scout out the place. The raid has to be soon.
What are we going to do?
I thought we'd get our hands on Pine and have a talk with him. Try to find out exactly what Mallory's planning to do and when.
I remember reading about Pine on that wanted poster. He's a vicious killer like the rest of the gang. What makes you think he'll tell us anything?
Why, I got a crazy redskin who likes to torture white eyes that I'll turn loose on him if he doesn't talk.
My professors would be so disappointed in me.
Come on. We'll wait till he comes out of the Black Bull and grab him.
They angled across the street toward the saloon and took up positions in the mouth of the alley beside the Black Bull. Time dragged, but they waited. After a while, Jacob Pine came out of the saloon and walked over to the hitch rack where his horse was tied. By the time Jacob Pine reached the animal, Matt and Sam were ambling past as if they had no interest in him. The Blood Brothers struck swift and unexpected. Matt clamped an arm around Pine's neck from behind and dragged him away from the horse. With his other hand, he jerked the gun from the holster on Pine's hip. At the same time, Sam put a hand over Pine's mouth to stifle any outcry. Sam held up his bowie knife with his other hand and let Pine see it. Pine got a good look at it since the tip of the deadly blade was only a couple of inches from his right eye. Pine started to struggle as Matt dragged him toward the alley. Sam tapped the owl hoot on the head with the bowie's handle, stunning him for a moment. They took him behind the Black Bull, lashed his hands behind his back with his own belt, and propped him against the wall. Matt switched his grip so his hand was fastened around Pine's throat, keeping him from crying out. Sam leaned close to the outlaw, weaving the knife in front of his face. Enough moonlight fell so silvery glints flashed off the blade.
Listen, mister, we know who you are. You're going to answer some questions. If you don't, I'll let my friend here go to work on you with that knife. First, he'll cut off your ears.
Sam tapped each ear in turn with the flat of the blade. Pine shuddered.
When he gets done with that, he'll slice off your nose. Then things will start to get painful.
Sam leaned closer.
I'm going to let off on your throat. Don't try to yell. Don't even think about it. You got that?
What do you hombres want? If you're planning to rob me...
We want answers.
I don't know nothing.
You know your name, don't you? You know you're Jacob Pine.
You got the wrong man, mister, I swear.
Don't waste our time. Where's Mallory? When does he plan to raid the town?
Oh, damn it, I don't know what you're talking about.
Knowing Mallory's reputation, Matt wasn't surprised Pine didn't want to talk. Matt looked at Sam and nodded. Sam grabbed Pine's left ear and pulled it out straight from the outlaw's head.
Stop! Don't do it! I'll tell you what you want to know!
Matt smelled the acrid stink of urine and knew Pine pissed his pants in terror. That was easier than Matt thought it might be. He hoped they wouldn't have to cut the varmint's ears off for real. They might have done it, though, with the life of every man, woman, and child in Sweet Apple at stake.
Make it quick. Where's Mallory and the rest of the gang?
About 5 miles north of here.
Why hasn't he raided this settlement already? We know he planned to.
Deuce found out. The army's bringing a shipment of guns through here on the train. He's going to hit the town while the train stopped here and get the rifles, too.
Matt and Sam exchanged a quick glance. This was the first they heard about a shipment of military rifles. That put a different light on things. Deuce Mallory was going after a bigger prize than usual. He'd be more ruthless than usual.
So he's been waiting for those guns to get here?
Yeah.
When do they do?
Pine hesitated. Sam reached for his ear again.
Tomorrow morning. They'll be on the westbound train that's supposed to roll in at 9 o'clock. But that ain't all.
A note of eagerness came into Pine's voice, as if he thought spilling something else might improve his chances of getting out of this without losing his ears or nose or any other important body parts.
Deuce ain't the only one after the guns.
What are you talking about?
There's a Mexican. Diego Alcazario. Calls himself a revolutionary, but I reckon he's just another bandito. He knows about the rifles, too, and plans to steal them.
A chill went through Matt. Having the threat of Mallory's gang hanging over Sweet Apple was bad enough. Now Pine was telling them they might have to deal with a small army of Mexican bandits as well.
Alcazario's planning to hit the train here?
I don't know. Oh, that's the truth, mister. I got no idea what the greaser's gonna do, but he might. That's worth something, ain't it? Ain't it?
You know anything else?
Not a goddamn thing, I swear. I'd tell you if I did. How about letting me go? My life won't be worth a plug nickel if Deuce ever finds out I talked. I'll ride west to El Paso and you'll never see me again. I won't warn Deuce that you're expecting him, I swear it.
Mallory sent you into town to have a look around and make sure nobody knows he's coming?
That's right.
What's he gonna do if you don't come back?
He'll attack the town anyway. He wants those guns more than I've ever seen him want anything before. I helped you, didn't I, mister? You can give me a break. It won't hurt nothing.
It'd hurt the memory of those people you helped murder in Buckskin.
Sam sheathed the bowie knife, bent at the knees, and let the senseless owl hoot fall forward onto his shoulder. He straightened.
We're taking him to Seymour's office and locking him up?
That's right. We need to tell Seymour things are even worse than we thought.
In less than 12 hours, the train carrying those rifles would be rolling into Sweet Apple, with killers converging on the town from the north and possibly from the south. Matt and Sam had a lot to do between now and then. Deuce Mallory paced back and forth on the sandy rise, his anger growing with each step. He peered to the south, where the settlement of Sweet Apple was located about a half a mile away. Then he glanced to the east, where the sky was growing gray with the approach of dawn. Mallory swung around toward the rest of the gang. They sat their saddles uneasily, knowing Mallory was upset, and knowing as well there was no telling what he would do if he lost his temper.
Jake should have been back a long time ago.
Maybe he just got drunk and passed out in some whorehouse, Deuce.
Yeah, he knows better than to do something like that. He knew I was expecting his report. He got himself arrested and thrown in jail, or gunned down in a fight. Sweet Apple's a rough place. Plenty of hombres there who fancied themselves fast guns. Somebody could have goaded Pine into a showdown, I suppose.
That'd be the best thing for us, in a way. But what if the law caught him? What if the folks in Sweet Apple know we're coming?
It doesn't matter. Those rifles will be there in a little while, and I want them. I intend to have them. I'm not afraid of a bunch of settlers. Those hard cases in Sweet Apple aren't nearly as dangerous as they think they are.
Larrabee looked like he hoped Mallory was right about that. Mallory turned in his saddle.
Gus.
Yeah, Deuce?
We're proceeding as planned. Take the boys you picked out and plant that dynamite where I told you to.
Sure, boss. Once it blows, that train won't be able to go nowhere. It'll be stuck there while we clean it out.
That was the idea. Get going.
Brody and several of the other outlaws would do their work under cover of what little night was left.
Are you sure about this, Deuce? We could be riding into a trap.
The trap hasn't been made that can catch me.
Soon that whole town is going to belong to us.
South of Sweet Apple, another group of riders moved through the night toward the settlement. Water streamed from the coats of their horses from fording the Rio Grande a short time earlier. Diego Alcazario rode proudly at the head of the group. If only those who thought of him as simply a bandit could see him now, he told himself, riding like a general at the head of an army. A small army, to be sure, but still an army. Alcazario called a halt when he and his men were approximately a mile south of the town. They hid themselves in a dry wash so anyone riding by in the early morning wouldn't see them. All the rebels had to do was wait until the train carrying the guns arrived at Sweet Apple. From here, they would be able to hear the train's whistle as it approached. That would be the signal for them to mount up and begin their charge. They would sweep into town, ruthlessly overwhelming any opposition, capture the train station, kill the small force of gringo soldiers guarding the weapons, and take the rifles for themselves. Alcazario could see the whole thing in his mind, as vividly as if painted on canvas before him. He felt impatience and suppressed it. Soon, his revolution would enjoy its greatest success. He could afford to wait a little while. He even told himself to savor the moment. By the time this morning was over, Diego Alcazario and his men would be a force to be reckoned with in Mexico. El Presidente Diaz would quiver in fear if he knew what was going to happen today. Alcazario smiled. That humiliating image of Diaz in his mind helped the time pass. Seymour was shocked when Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves brought in the prisoner and tossed him in one of the cells. He was more shocked when the Blood Brothers explained about the army rifles arriving on the train the next morning at 9 o'clock. Too tempting a target for both the gang of outlaws and a band of Mexican revolutionaries to pass up. This was the first Seymour heard about a shipment of guns or Mexican rebels. As he tried to take it all in, he wanted to ask himself what else could possibly go wrong. He managed not to do that. Why tempt fate? When it came to Seymour Standish, fate couldn't resist. The first thing Seymour did after Matt and Sam explained the situation was to walk down to the adobe cottage where Maggie lived and knock on the door. They parted somewhat uneasily earlier, after Matt's visit to the marshal's office and the revelations Seymour shared with Maggie. Now he wanted to give her the whole story. She needed to know.
Oh my God, so soon?
9 o'clock in the morning. But we'll be ready for them. And that includes you, Maggie.
Me? What can I do to help fight outlaws and revolutionaries?
You'll have a school full of students. It's a nice, sturdy building, and it's quite a distance from the train station. Matt, Sam, and I are going to pass the word everyone in town should send their children to school in the morning, even the ones who normally don't. Once they're there, keep them there until Matt or Sam or I come to you and tell you it's all right to let them go again.
You're counting on me to protect all the children in town?
I have confidence in you. And there will be several armed guards there with you, too.
Oh, Seymour.
She came into his arms, causing him to reflect wryly that the situation wasn't all bad. It gave him an excuse to hug and comfort her. After leaving Maggie's a short time later, Seymour joined the effort Matt and Sam already had underway, going around town, alerting their makeshift defense force of the impending attack. Not only that, but now that they knew the time of the raid, they began to spread the word generally, knocking on doors, waking people up, and recruiting more defenders. Most people agreed to send their children to the school first thing in the morning, with only a few insisting on keeping the youngsters with them. Matt, Sam, and Seymour made it clear it was important to keep things looking as normal as possible in Sweet Apple the next morning. Seymour questioned the Blood Brothers about that very thing.
Isn't it possible if we fortify the town so Mallory knows we're ready for him, he'll decide not to attack us?
The chances of that happening are pretty slim. If this was one of his normal raids, if it wasn't for those guns coming in on the train, he might decide it wasn't worth the fight. But according to Pine, he wants those rifles so much he'd risk it no matter how prepared we are.
That's why our best hope is to take him by surprise. Let him come in thinking he's going to ride roughshod over the town.
And give him a hot lead welcome he isn't expecting.
That made sense, Seymour supposed. He had to put his trust in Matt and Sam. They knew a lot more about fighting outlaws and killers than he did. They had been at it for years, instead of days. By the time the sky turned orange with dawn and the sun peeked over the horizon, Armed men were hidden on the roofs of half the buildings in town. Others waited inside or in alleys. It was still a couple of hours until the train carrying the rifles would arrive. A few men walked or rode or drove wagons along the street just to make the town look normal in case anyone was observing from a distance. Seymour, Matt, and Sam waited in the marshal's office, watching the performance. Seymour felt himself sweating despite the cooler morning air. The ticking of the clock on the wall was unnaturally loud.
Time sure flies when you're having fun, don't it, Marshal?
Seymour's spectacles slipped down a little on his nose.
Remind me again why I decided to stop being the most cowardly man in the West? Seymour the Lily-Livered wouldn't ever get into a mess like this. He'd faint dead away from fear first.
All three men stiffened and glanced at the clock. Straight up 9. The train carrying the army rifles was on time in Sweet Apple.
No need to hurry, Seymour. We've got plenty of time.
Matt and Sam flanked the marshal. The Blood Brothers carried their own Winchesters, while Seymour's hands were wrapped around one of the shotguns from the office. There was nothing unusual about a lawman and his deputies meeting a train. Most Frontier Star Packers would mosey down to the depot whenever a train came in, just to see who got off. It was part of the job. They didn't know which of the freight cars the crates of the rifles and the troopers guarding them were in, so Matt nodded toward the conductor as the blue-uniformed man hopped down from one of the passenger cars. With Matt and Sam right behind him, Seymour went over to the conductor.
I'm Marshal Standish. I have a very important question to ask you.
What's that, Marshal?
In which of the cars is that shipment of army rifles?
I don't know what you're talking about, Marshal.
I think you do. There's a shipment of 500 army rifles on this train being guarded by a squad of troopers from Fort Sam Houston. The guns are bound for Fort Bliss in El Paso. Now do you know what I'm talking about?
Ah, damn it. That was supposed to be a secret. The army swore to me nobody would know about it.
It gets worse. There's a gang of outlaws who have their eyes on those guns. They're liable to attack at any time, so you'd better warn the officer in charge of those guards.
I reckon I'd better.
Matt looked around and saw a cloud of dust rising a couple of hundred yards east of the station.
They blew the tracks to the west, too! The train's stuck here!
Conductor, go on the soldiers!
As the three men ran to the front of the station, they saw the outlaw horde boiling down the main street of Sweet Apple toward them. But they were meeting unexpectedly fierce resistance. Shots blasted from the men hidden on the roofs, defenders inside buildings and on the ground unleashing a withering storm of lead, too. Some of the men fell from the deadly, accurate fire of the outlaws, with more of the raiders pitched from their saddles. That didn't stop Deuce Mallory and the knot of men who were right behind him, probably the rest of his most trusted lieutenants. They kept galloping toward the train station, firing as they came. Matt and Sam each dropped to a knee, brought their rifles to their shoulders, and opened up on the outlaws. Flame lanced from the muzzles of the Winchesters. A cloud of gun smoke and dust rolled over the street, fogging the morning air. Some of the soldiers from the train ran around the station and joined the fight. That was enough to turn the tide for good. Bullets shredded Mallory's men. The boss outlaw himself, though, seemed to have some sort of mystical shield about him, continuing the attack untouched, despite the swarm of bullets in the air around him. He was close enough now so Matt and Sam could see his face. They saw disbelief there. Disbelief his plans weren't working. Mallory's intended victims were fighting back rather than dying. But even stronger was the fanatical hatred distorting the features of Edward Deuce Mallory. For years, he devoted his life to evil and was convinced nothing could stop him. Now, without warning, everything was going wrong. So far in the battle, Seymour hadn't fired a shot. Now Mallory was bearing down on him as he stood there between Matt and Sam. Seymour lifted the shotgun. He was just acting instead of thinking, instead of being scared of what might happen. Just do what's right, he told himself. He saw the flash of Mallory's gun, felt the fiery path the bullet traced along his side. The impact of the slug twisted him half around. But Seymour didn't fall, didn't falter. He lined both barrels of the greener on Mallory and pulled the triggers. Mallory was dead before his body thudded to the ground and sprawled limply in the dust. Matt Bodine was on his feet again, catching hold of Seymour's arm to steady the wounded marshal. Seymour felt a hot wetness on his side.
Am I hit?
Look to me like you just got nicked. I don't reckon it's too bad.
Is it over?
All of Mallory's men were down. Some were dead, others badly wounded. But the battle wasn't over.
The Mexican rebels! Has to be!
They ran around the station to the end of the platform and looked through one of the gaps between the cars. Another force of mounted men charged toward Sweet Apple, this time from the south. Matt caught glimpses through the dust of tall, steeple-crowned sombreros.
It's Alcazario and his men! Let's get on top of one of those cars! Seymour, get us some help!
Seymour nodded and turned to run unsteadily back to the street.
Over here! The Mexicans are coming from the south!
Meanwhile, Matt and Sam dropped their empty rifles and scrambled up to the top of one of the freight cars, using the grab bars bolted to the car as a ladder. They unleathered their Colts and started firing down into the mass of bandits who closed in on the train from that side. Bullets sang through the air around them and plucked at their clothes. Suddenly, the door on the south side of the freight car on which they stood slid open.
Yee-haw! They got a Gatling gun in there!
Men flew from their saddles, some of them almost cut in half by the bullets. Shouting curses in Spanish, many who weren't gunned down turned to flee. Some of them made it, and some of them didn't. Matt and Sam accounted for some who didn't. A bullet clipped Matt on the thigh and knocked his leg out from under him.
Matt!
I'm fine. Get that big hombre. I'll bet he's Alcazario.
Sam snapped a couple of shots at the man, but more dust and smoke swirled as he pulled the trigger. And when it cleared, his target was gone. Sam didn't know whether he hit the man or not. Once the back of the second attack was broken, it didn't take long for the surviving members of Alcazario's band to take off to the tall and uncut. The town's defenders and the troopers threw a few last shots after them to speed them on their way, as Sam helped Matt to his feet.
They won't slow down until the Rio's a long way behind them. They're going home empty-handed, too.
The Blood Brothers climbed back down to the ground, Matt somewhat awkwardly because of his wound. He leaned on Sam as they went to look for Seymour. They found him sitting in a chair inside the station lobby with Maggie Orion fussing over him, worried to death because of the bloodstain on his shirt. A gray-haired man wearing the uniform of a major looked at the wound.
Well, he'll be fine, ma'am. That bullet just grazed the marshal. I'll have one of my men patch it up if you don't have a doctor here.
Ignoring the major's hand on his shoulder, Seymour pushed himself to his feet as he saw Matt and Sam.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I got a little scratch too, but it's not any worse than that nick you got, Seymour. Somehow Sam here came through without even that much.
Clean living.
Dumb luck is more like it.
Alcazario. Wasn't that his name?
We don't know if he got away or not, but the fight's over. It really is this time. The bandits who lived through it lit a shuck out of here. They'll be licking their wounds for a long time.
And the army rifles?
Safe and secure, thanks to you and your friends, Marshal. I'm Major Stillwell, and I'm in your debt, Marshal.
Standish. Marshal Seymour Standish.
Not that.
That's right. Marshal Seymour Standish, who just killed Deuce Mallory and broke up maybe the worst gang of owl hoots and killers west of the Mississippi. Just imagine what he could do if he wasn't the most cowardly man in the West.
The children. Are the children all right?
The fighting never came near the school. You were right, Seymour. That was the safest place for them.
I'm glad.
Seymour put his arm around and drew her against him, being careful to hug her with the side away from his wound.
But these two fellows deserve all the real credit and thanks. They were the ones who made it all possible.
We weren't holding you up when Mallory was practically right on top of you and bullets were flying all around.
That was all you, Seymour.
Maybe. Now, if you'll excuse me, there's something I've been meaning to do.
Kiss that pretty little gal you've got your arm around?
Later. Later. For sure.
Then his eyes rolled up and he fainted. Not from fear this time, but because of the blood he shed defending everything dear to him.
The hero of Sweet Apple.
Cornelius Standish was reading an Eastern paper that picked up a story from Texas. A story about the fierce battle between outlaws and Mexican bandits on one side and the army and the citizens of Sweetapple on the other. According to the paper, those citizens were led in their valiant defense of the town by their fighting marshal, Seymour Standish.
Was he badly hurt?
Rebecca brought the newspaper to Standish, but hadn't a chance to read the story thoroughly.
He's fine. That boy has more dumb luck than anybody I've ever seen. Obviously, Grant and Morelli failed. For all I know, they may be dead by now. Seymour probably killed them. According to this, he's turned into some sort of pistolier.
Rebecca didn't see how that was possible. The Seymour she knew was terrified of his own shadow. How could he transform himself into an actual lawman? Yet it seemed undeniable that was what happened. The newspaper story made it clear Seymour spearheaded the defense of the town and played a major role in routing the bandits. Rebecca picked it up and read it while Standish fumed.
Well, look at it this way. From the sound of this, Seymour intends to remain in Sweetapple. At least he's out of your hair, Cornelius.
The hell with that! He still owns half the company! He's still a threat to my plans!
Standish leaned back in his chair and chewed on his lower lip for a moment as he frowned and thought. When he spoke again, it was with a cool, deadly calm.
Clearly, my mistake was to trust someone else with such an important job. I'm going to have to supervise it personally.
You mean?
I mean I'm going to Texas. And once I'm there, I'll make sure that spineless little worm never comes back to ruin things for me again.
Rebecca's heart started to pound. From what she read in the paper, Seymour wasn't as spineless as when he left New Jersey. Somehow, he grew a backbone. But would it be enough to protect him against his own uncle? Rebecca didn't know, but she had a feeling Cornelius Standish would have a surprise waiting for him when he got to Texas. And so might she, because she knew, suddenly, she was going too. She had to see the new Seymour Standish with her own eyes. Hiding in a cave like animals. It was disgraceful. The remnants of his army were forced to flee when they encountered a patrol of rurales not long after crossing the border into Mexico. Alcazario ordered the retreat because he lost too many men in Sweetapple. The survivors were too shot up to mount an effective fight. After a running battle, they finally shook the pursuit and slunk into the hills to hide. Florio Cruz came into the cave, his knife-thin figure silhouetted for a second against the light outside. His wounded left arm hung in a crude sling. Alcazario himself was sitting propped up against the wall of the cave. Two bullets tore through his body, but went all the way through. The wounds were now bound up tightly. Alcazario was too tough to be killed by only two bullets. He would recover to fight again, and soon. Cruz hunkered on his heels.
I have posted sentries as you ordered, Diego. No one will get in or out.
Some of the men still want to go home, do they? The dogs. I am tempted to let them go, so they will not hinder us when we assemble another force of real fighting men.
It may be harder to find men who want to ride with us now. Once the story of what happened at Sweetapple spreads...
Sweetapple! How I hate the name of that place! The men will come. But we need some plan to attract them. Something daring and audacious. Something that will strike at the gringos.
I thought our goal was to overthrow that pig of a Diaz.
It is. But everybody hates the gringos. Diaz will still be there after I have my revenge on that damn Sweetapple. And everyone in it.
Seymour still moved a little stiffly from the bandages wrapped tightly around his midsection under his clothes. But several days had passed since the battle around the railroad station, and he was determined to resume his duties. Matt and Sam were filling in as deputies, unofficially, since the town couldn't afford to pay them anything and the Blood Brothers didn't want a real job anyway. But today, Seymour got dressed and was walking down the street with a shotgun tucked under his arm. Sweetapple grew quiet and peaceful since all the trouble with Mallory's gang and Alcazario's banditos. But Seymour figured all hell could break loose again at any moment. All hell would break loose again sooner or later. That was just the way these frontier towns were. He took a deep breath, wincing a little as it pulled at his bandages. He didn't care. It felt good being back to work. Not that he didn't enjoy lying in bed with Maggie fussing over him for a few days. They were closer than ever now. Seymour found himself filled with the real hope they might have a future together. Because he intended to stay in Sweet Apple from now on, he needed to get in touch with Cornelius, he told himself, and let his uncle know he needed to find a new salesman to handle this territory. Seymour's days of selling dry goods were over. Matt and Sam were sitting in front of the hotel, their chairs tipped back as they took life easy for a change. Matt's leg was a little stiff and sore from the bullet crease on his thigh, but the wound was healing well. He knew he'd be able to ride again before too much longer. He wasn't in any hurry to leave, though. His restless nature hadn't reasserted itself just yet. Sam nudged him in the side.
Look who's coming.
Matt grinned as he let the front legs of his chair settle down to the porch. He stood up and leaned on the railing.
Howdy, Marshall. It's good to see you up and about again.
It's good to be up and about again. I take it everything's been quiet?
That's right. We thought there might be some trouble a little while ago when folks from the Double C and PAX came in about the same time. But they went on about their business.
The Double C was the ranch owned by Shad Colton, so named because of his wife Carolyn's initials. PAX, of course, was the Paxton spread. The wagons came into town from both ranches, carrying the Colton and Paxton women, evidently intent on picking up supplies and doing some other shopping. Those wagons were trailed by an escort of cowboys from each ranch, and those tough rannies eyed each other suspiciously as they passed in the street. There was certainly no love lost between the two spreads, although Jesse Colton and Sandy Paxton still seemed to be good friends and greeted each other warmly. So far, they weren't having any part of the rift. The riders from the Double C went to the Black Bull while Jesse and her mother were shopping, and the Paxhands went to one of the other saloons. As long as the groups kept their distance from each other, there likely wouldn't be any problems.
I can't thank you too enough for everything you've done. If you hadn't shown up when you did, the town might have been wiped out.
Nah, you'd have figured out what to do, Seymour. You've got a lawman's instincts.
I wish I could believe that.
Believe it? That's the first step to making it come true.
You know, that's probably right. Now that I'm back on my feet again, I can't ask you to stay here and help me. I'll be all right.
I don't reckon I'm in shape to ride just yet.
We don't mind hanging around for a while. Sweet Apple sort of grows on you, despite the rough edges.
Yes, it certainly does grow on you.
The three men swung around and looked to see a confrontation going on in front of the general store. Both ranch wagons were pulled up in front of the high porch that served as a loading dock. The Colton and Paxton women stood there looking distressed, while the cowboys from each of the spreads jawed angrily at each other in the street. The punchers got their drinks, then headed to the store to accompany the women back home. Bad luck put both groups there at the same time.
That's not good. I'd better get down there and put a stop to that before it turns into a real ruckus.
A real ruckus? You're starting to sound like a Westerner, Seymour.
There's nothing I'd rather be.
Before he could get there, somebody threw a punch. In the blink of an eye, a brawl was going on in the middle of the street between the Double C punchers and the Pack Riders, despite the shouts of the women for the men to stop it.
Looks like Seymour may need a hand after all.
Oh, yeah. Let's go.
With grins on their faces, the Blood Brothers plunged right back into trouble.
Blood Bond, Texas Gundown is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Thomas Penny, Dylan Lynch, James Lewis, Kate Torrey, Jeff Baker, Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, James Konacek, Sonny Lasky, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Andy Clements, Tim Carlin, Christopher Grayville, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Karen Carbone, Nanette Savard, Bobby Aselford, Nathaniel Perry, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Book adapted for graphic audio by Timothy H. Lynch. Dialogue editing by Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler and Brian Patton. Original score by Johann Detweiler and Brian Patton. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Bloodbond, be sure to look for The Last Gunfighter series, available at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Death to the Americans!
Indeed, death to the Americans. The United States supported Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The Americans helped the Shah stay on his peacock throne to oppress and defile the people of Iran. Some of you were but children when the Savak carried innocent people away to be tortured and murdered. Yet, God is great. You smote the American pawn in Iran. You began the Islamic Holy War against the great Satan. Saddam Hussein carried it forward. Saddam's armies fought the infidel nations of the West. God is good, for now we take holy war to the Americans.
A sudden wave of global terrorism has all the hallmarks of an Islamic jihad. Stony Man goes on red alert to determine if these atrocities are state-sponsored, carried out to draw the U.S. into full-scale war.
So Horan has poison in his veins. I assume that means he won't give up and will sacrifice as many lives as possible if he thinks there's no way out.
Major Horan carries death inside him. He will spread death as if a contagious disease. I think he wants to do this. Death is Haran's only concept of victory.
And he's gonna get a personal victory. And his last.
Oh, this neighborhood seems to be getting worse.
I noticed.
Your hand grenade seems to have made an impression on them. Maybe another one will discourage them from rushing the building.
Let's see what two will do.
Able Team, Phoenix Force, and Mac Bolan join forces across the globe as Armageddon is about to become a reality.
I hate to harp on this, but they've probably got vats of chlorine, cyanide, various types of acid, and maybe tanks of concentrated hydrogen and oxygen gases.
Meaning we can get poisoned, blown up, and burned to a crisp all at once if we're not careful.
We're trying not to hit anything with bullets. I just hope nobody inside is suicidal.
Join the warriors of Stony Man Farm in an action-packed race against time in Stony Man Number 4.
You don't object to murder?
Not murder. Justice.
There were several names in the West that caused brave men to sit down and shut up. Smoke Jensen, Falcon McAllister, Louis Longmont, and Frank Morgan.
Enough talk, old man! Grab iron!
You want a shooting, boy? You're gonna have to start it.
You think I won't?
I hope you don't, kid.
You're gonna die, Morgan!
We all die, kid. Some long before their time.
I thought all them stories about you was just talk.
I wish it was.
Once, Frank Morgan had a wife and a future on the land. Now Morgan's taken up the one skill that always came easy, gunfighting. And with nothing left to lose, he's the last man who will ever back down.
Who the hell are you?
Frank Morgan.
Oh, hell.
creators that brought you the critically acclaimed Eagles series and the first Mountain Man, there's a new sheriff in town, and he's tougher than rawhide and as quick as a striking rattler. Frank Morgan is the Last Gunfighter. William W. Johnstone's epic new western, now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.